Parsha Shmini does not often get the opportunity to really be studied because Parsha Shmini sometimes gets lost in the shuffle of Pesach. But this year, since Parsha Shmini falls out a little bit before Pesach due to the fact that we had 2 months of Adar, therefore we have the opportunity to talk about some of the themes. So, by way of introduction to what we're going to speak about, which is the major theme of Parsha Shmini, there are 17 mitzvos in the Parsha. 7 of them are all regarding ma'achalos asuros, which means forbidden foods. So it refers to fish that you're allowed to eat, animals that you're allowed to consume, birds that are allowed or not allowed. A lot to talk about there. But by way of introduction to that, we know that we are coming up to the Yom Tov, to the celebration of Pesach. On a normal year, when we don't have a double month of Adar, we always have Parsha Shmini right after Pesach. Parsha Shmini always comes right after Yom Tov of Pesach. The Arizal points out, why is the word Pesach, what does that refer to? So he says, I think they quote this in the name of the Zohar HaKadosh as well, that it's Pesach, that on Pesach you have to emphasize the fact that your mouth is able to speak. We know that one of the most important mitzvahs of the Yom Tov, of the holiday of Pesach, is V'higadot Levincha, that we have an obligation to use our mouths and to speak to our children and to share the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim together with them. Not only that, from the very beginning of the story, Vayomer Hashem el Moshe, Bo el Paro, the beginning of Parshas Bo. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Bo el Paro, that's the first question. A little bit of a curious phrase. Why does it say Bo? It should say Lech el Paro. What does it mean? Bo means come. So Rashi on Chumash tells us from the Medrash, the reason why is because HaKadosh Baruch Hu was saying, I'm going to go with you. I'm not going to send you alone. You should be comfortable. You should be confident in the fact that we are going to go together. And that's what it means, Bo el Paro, and not Lech el Paro. And what does HaKadosh Baruch Hu instruct Moshe Rabbeinu to do? To go there and to perform all the miracles and to show him all the signs and all the great things. And all of that is for the objective. Leman tesaper ba'azne bincha uben bincha eis asher isalalti b'mitzrayim. From the very outset of Moshe Rabbeinu's instruction to go save the Jewish people, from the very first moment he is told that the objective ultimately is to be able to have the opportunity to tell it over to our children, which is why Magid takes center stage on Leil HaSeder. Because it is the Yom Tov, it is the holiday of Pesach. An Eved, one who is a servant, does not have the opportunity to use his mouth. He cannot talk back to his master. He doesn't have a right to give an opinion. Nobody cares about his opinion. He is supposed to be limited to his job and do nothing more and nothing less than what he is instructed to do. And here, we have the opportunity as B'nai Chorin, as people who became free, to use our mouths and to use our voices for positive reasons, which is perhaps the reason why immediately after Pesach is finished, we start with the mitzvah of Sfiras HaOmer, which is using our mouths every night, again, for a mitzvah to count up to the day when we have the opportunity to celebrate the giving of the Torah on Chag HaShavuos. Aside from the focus on Dibur B'Peh, aside from the focus on using our mouths, there is also a major emphasis on Pesach on the mitzvah Achila, on using our mouths not only to speak, but also to eat. So we have the opportunity on Pesach to eat matzah, and to eat maror, and to drink 4 cups of wine. And on a regular year, as we mentioned, the parsha that comes immediately after Pesach is not a coincidence that it happens to be Parshas Shmini, which talks about the way that one is supposed to use their mouth. On Leil HaSeder, we focus a lot on mitzvos that have to do with our mouths, not only with the way we speak, but also with the way that we consume food. After that, we have Parshas Tazria Mitzora, which talk about what? Saras comes from somebody who speaks Lashon Hara. Also, again, it's the emphasis on having the opportunity to understand how we're supposed to use our mouths. Now, in the very end of our parsha, we will find there's a pasuk, Perek Yud Aleph, pasuk Mem Hei, Ki Ani Hashem, Hamale Eschem Me'eretz Mitzrayim. I am the God who took you out of Mitzrayim, Liyos Lachem Lelokim. So far that makes sense. I took you out of Mitzrayim, and I am your God. V'yisem kedoshim ki kadosh ani. And based on all of the instructions that I gave you in this parsha about what you're allowed to eat, what you're not allowed to eat, what you can consume and what perhaps not, what's kosher and what's not kosher, you will become kodesh. Now, the Gemara asks a very obvious question, but Matzia Daf Samach Aleph Amud Beis asked the Gemara, how does that have any connection? What is the relationship between eating the proper foods and us coming out of Mitzrayim? I understand when you tell me that you came out of Mitzrayim, and when you were in Eved, you didn't have a mouth, you didn't have a voice, you weren't able to express yourself. And now you have mitzvah Sheva Dibur. Now you have the mitzvah of Magid. Now you have the mitzvah of education. Now you have an opportunity to use your voices for positive things. But what is the connection between ma'achalos asuras, between kosher food, and coming out of Mitzrayim. Now, you can say in a general context that the connection is when we came out of Mitzrayim, we got all the mitzvahs HaTorah when we came to Har Sinai. So there is a direct relationship between Yetzias Mitzrayim and all the mitzvahs. But why in particular here do we find that the Torah puts it together? The mitzvah of making sure we eat kosher food, not to eat ma'achalos asuros, and the coming out of Mitzrayim. Ask the Gemara, what is the connection? Listen carefully. Says the Gemara, Yetzias Mitzrayim dekasev rachmana gabishratzim lamali. In our parsha, one of the things that is discussed is that you're not allowed to eat insects. Ask the Gemara, why do we have a connection between Mitzrayim and the consumption of insects that is not permissible for us? Answers the Gemara as follows. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Anihu Shehevchanti b'Mitzrayim at the time of Makas B'choros. Who died? Not a trick question. Who died? Only the firstborns. Now, you walk into a house and you don't have any prior knowledge of who lives in this house and how old the children are and who was born when. You don't have any birth certificates, so you walk into the house, how do you know who's supposed to get killed? How would you know who the Bechor is? Maybe somebody dressed up, maybe somebody was hiding under a bed. How are you supposed to know? Says HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Ani hu shehevchanti bein tipa shabachar letipa she'ena shabachar. I, the Ribbono Shel Olam, am the one who is able to discern between who is the real Bechor, the real firstborn of every family, and who is not. And as much as they may have tried to hide, and as much as they may have tried to trick, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, I know the difference between who is a Bechor and who is not. So too says HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I am paying attention, and I know the difference between somebody who claims to be keeping kosher and somebody who doesn't. What is the difference between somebody who is Shomer Kashrus and somebody who is not? The difference is a hair, a needle of a difference between something that is kosher and something that is not. The Gemara says in Maseches Chulin, when you do the mitzvah of Shechita, which gives you the opportunity to eat meat, what is the difference between a kosher Shechita and a non-kosher Shechita? Says the Gemara, Rubo Shalkana. If you have most of the esophagus that is going to be shechted, then it's kosher. If you have less than 51%, it is going to be treif. What is the difference between those two? A tiny hair's breadth. It's nothing. But says the Gemara, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I who took the Jewish people out of Mitzrayim and knew how to discern the difference between the Bechorim in Mitzrayim and those who were not, I knew how to make the distinction between who was supposed to be killed in Makas Bechoros and who wasn't. I am also the same one who is paying attention to the way that you observe the laws of Kashrus. And sometimes the difference between something that is kosher and that is not is a very minimal difference. Sometimes you'll have an ingredient in some kind of food item, and you say to yourself, it doesn't really matter, what can really be bad? And the answer is, it can be really bad. I have a neighbor on my block who just told me this week, we were not even talking about Parsha Shmini, we weren't talking about anything from this discussion, he just happened to mention to me that he went to, I forgot where it was, Cancun, I think he said, and he said a lot of Jews were there, I think it was during winter break, and they were sitting at the pool, all right, so sitting at the pool, I mean, not so all right, but fine. So they were at the pool, and he said that they were all ordering drinks. There was like a bartender outside who was making drinks. So he said he saw that everybody was ordering drinks, so he also decided he was going to order a drink, but instead he decided to go over to the bartender and ask what they put in the drinks. So they showed him. They put in this ingredient, they put in that ingredient, or whatever it was. And then everything seemed to be kosher. And then he told him that they put in for some extra kick in the drink, whatever the alcoholic beverage was, they put in for extra kick, they put in an extract of clamshells or something like that. And he was like, who would have ever thought? You know, who would have ever thought? And he basically said, do you know that you have all Jews who are here for winter break? Do you know that all of them are not allowed to eat this? Anyway, so you have to be very careful. And what is the difference between that little additive that is put into the drink and having the drink without it? Such a small amount, but you have to be careful. You have to be aware. The same person told me that people think they can go and eat guacamole. You go somewhere, you see guacamole on the table, like what can possibly be wrong? What could be in it? And the answer is there are, if you know anything about food, which I don't, but he said if you know anything about food, you never know what they put inside. There are certain additives that are put in. Now, Reb Tzadik HaKohen Milublin, I saw this morning, write something. It's amazing because I never look in the Sfarim of Reb Tzadik HaKohen, not because I don't like him, but just because I don't have them at home. And I happened to come across this morning something on Otzer HaChachma, which Reb Tzadok HaKohen writes in this week's Parsha, that Reb Tzadok explains, why is it that we have such a focus on Machalos Asuras? Why does the Torah go into such great detail? And why does the Torah say, if you eat Machalos Asuras, you're going to be holy, and if you don't eat it, you're not going to be holy? Why is everything based on Machalos Asuras? Not only that, we have an interesting Gemara in Meseches. One second, where is that Gemara? I'm out of order here. That's what happens when you prepare so late at night. I'm sorry. So we have a Gemara. A Medrash Tanchuma. Sorry, next week's Parsha. The Medrash wants to know, why is there a relationship between Parshas Tazria and Parshas Shemini? So I would have said, just happens to be that Parshas Tazria comes after Parshas Shemini. But says the Medrash, it cannot just be that that's the way it turned out. It's not just coincidental. Says the Medrash, Tanchuma, next week's Parsha. Why is Parsha Tazria right after Parsha Shemini? Because what do we talk about in Parsha Shemini? Machalos Asuras. What do we talk about in the beginning of Parsha Tazria? Anybody know? Isha ki Tazria v'yaldo zachar, a woman who is going to be pregnant and then gives birth, and then it's going to be a baby boy, that child will have a bris milah. Says the Medrash Tanchuma. What is the smichas haparshias? What is the relationship? Says the Medrash, the relationship is that before a child is born, before a child comes into the world, HaKadosh Baruch Hu takes that child and he says, make sure that when you live on this earth, you don't eat machalos asuras. Fascinating. HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't say, make sure you keep Shabbos. He doesn't say, make sure you do this or you do that. Make sure to stay away from this place or the other place. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, make sure that you're careful about machalos asuras. Why? Why does he choose machalos asuras? Why is that such a focus? And that is the question that Reb Tzadok raises. He doesn't bring that medrash in next week's Parsha, but it is something that he raises. And the answer that he writes is, because if you go back in history, the very first mistake that a human being made on this earth was all about machalos asuras. It was all about eating something that they weren't allowed to eat. And that is not just something that coincidentally happened, that Adam and Chava ate something they weren't allowed to eat from the Eitz Hadas. That is, in some way, he feels instructive, that machalos asuras in some way is a very tempting part of our lives. It's something that becomes very, very difficult. And the way he writes it is, it's the shorish kol chet. It's where all of sin actually started. It's where all of sin actually comes from. Therefore, says Reb Tzadok HaKohen Milublin, that is why the Torah goes to such great lengths to tell us that we have to be careful about machalos asuras. So, says the Gemara Maseches Yuma Daf Lamites, if you look here on the top, Tana Dever Bishmal, Avera mitamtemes libo shel adam. I sent this out on the Canva. Avera mitamtemes libo shel adam. If a person does an avera, it is not just that you have disobeyed the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but it is mitamtem es halev. What does that mean? Rashi explains, mitamtem es halev means otemes visosemes mikol hachachma. In some way, it obstructs you. It gets in the way. It blocks you from being as successful as you should be. Now, that really applies to all prohibitions that one violates. However, we know that there is a very serious place, perhaps more so than other prohibitions, that machalos asuras seem to take. And the question is why? So we just mentioned Reb Tzadok HaKohen says, al pi hashkafa, the reason why is because that was the first sin of Adam and Chava. But beyond that, the Mesilas Yesharim writes in Perek Yud Aleph, look at number Beis, the reason why machalos asuras is considered to be more stringent than perhaps many of the other prohibitions in the Torah is because there's something very different about machalos asuras. Say, for example, the Torah says I'm not allowed to damage somebody else's property. I can't damage somebody else's property. So I'm driving my car and I hit somebody's bumper and I cause them damage and I just drive away. So I violated another lo signov, lo sigzo. You're not allowed to steal. That's stealing. You bumped into somebody's mirror. You damaged their property. You have to pay for it. Okay. When I eat something that's not kosher, says the Ramchal, I'm not just doing something externally, I'm actually taking it into my body. I'm ingesting it. And it's a full body experience. Therefore, he says, that is why the Torah says that this is considered to be more chamer than perhaps many of the other prohibitions that one may violate. This is something that is not only being done outside of myself, this is something that I'm bringing into my own personal life and something that is going to have far-reaching consequences, so much so that the Gemara says in Maseches Yuma, a woman who is nursing her child, the assumption is that whatever it is that the woman is going to eat will be reflected in the milk that she produces as well and then gives to her child to drink. And what is the nafkamina of that? So the doctors will say, I think doctors in our generation will say, therefore, a woman shouldn't eat, I don't know, gassy foods, a woman shouldn't eat something, certain foods, in order that the child shouldn't have an upset stomach from whatever it is that the mother is eating. But beyond that, the Gemara says that it's something much more than that. Look at the Gemara Maseches Sota Daf Yud Beis. We're told by Moshe Rabbeinu that when he was thrown into the Nile, and the daughter of Paro passes by and sees this young Jewish child, so she goes and asks to please find a menekes min ha'ivrios. She wants a woman who can nurse this child, but she insists that it has to be a Jewish woman. Why? There are plenty of women who are of childbearing age in the Egyptian community. Why do you have to find someone? Says the Gemara. Why did she insist that it had to be a Jewish woman? The answer is because she first tried to go to the Egyptian women, and Moshe Rabbeinu refused to nurse from any of them. Now, what does that mean? Moshe Rabbeinu, at such a young child, knew to refuse them? Good question, but the Gemara seems to say that he refused to drink from them because Pesha Asa the Dabar Mashchina, when you're going to have a mouth that is going to one day talk and communicate with the Shechina, it doesn't make sense that that mouth should eat, should ingest Machalas Asuras from the woman who is nursing him. And therefore the Gemara says we assume that that is something we have to be concerned about. So much so that the Ramah himself in Shulchan Aruch Yerudea Simen Pei Aleph, the Ramah says that a person should make sure that if you have to have somebody else, I don't know what you call it, a surrogate nurser, I don't know, if you want to have somebody else nurse the child, you have to make sure that the child should be nursed from a Jewish woman and not from a non-Jew in order that we shouldn't run into these problems. Now, the famous comment to Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky was, no, that's Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu was going to be the one who was going to talk to the Shechina. That's why he had to be more careful. But my child is not going to talk to the Shechina. What do I have to be worried about it? The answer is, the way I need to raise my children is I need to think my child can be the one someday that is going to talk to the Shechina just like Moshe Rabbeinu. And we need to allow our children to have every possible opportunity they can have to get to that level. And therefore, we need to do whatever we can to make sure that if they are going to be the ones chosen to be communicating with the Shechina, this will not be something that will stand in their way. That's the comment of Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, which gives us a little bit of an insight into Chinuch as well. But the Shach writes, the Shach, which is the most important commentary on Shulchan Aruch Yerudea, the Shach writes on that comment of the Ramah. So the Ramah says, if you have an opportunity to have somebody else nurse the child, the Ramah says, make sure that you have a Jewish woman nursing and not a non-Jewish woman, because we're concerned that whatever non-kosher food the non-Jewish woman may have eaten will then be transferred into the milk and will then go into the child and he will digest it, which will be a problem. Says the Shach, what if you have a Jewish woman who for whatever reason has to eat non-kosher food? Sometimes it happens. She has some kind of illness and she has no other option other than to eat non-kosher food. Says the Shach, even though she's Jewish, we should make sure that at that time, until it goes out of her system, wait a couple of hours or a couple of whatever, I don't know how long, until it goes out of her system, that child should not nurse from that woman, even if she's Jewish, along the lines of what the Ramah says here, because we don't want the child to have ma'achalas asuras in his system. So much so, we go a little further, the Shach writes as well, there is a sugya Maseches Yevamos. What is my responsibility when I see a young child doing something wrong? Let's say on Shabbos, I see a child takes a toy and starts playing. The child is very little, doesn't have an understanding of Shabbos, anything. So the child takes a toy, turns on the motor, and starts playing with something that's lighting up on Shabbos or whatever it is. Do I have to stop the child from doing it? I didn't ask the child to do it, but do I have to stop the child from doing it? This is a big discussion in Maseches Yevamos, Daf Kuf Yud Daled, where the Gemara discusses how far do I need to go out of my way to make sure that my child or somebody else's child doesn't do something wrong that the Torah doesn't allow an adult to do. The conclusion that the Gemara comes to, a very, very complicated sugya with a lot of discussion in the Rishonim about it as well. The bottom line in the Shulchan Aruch is, if my child is doing something on his or her own without my instruction, ein mitzuvan la'afrisho. I don't need to stop the child. I'm not allowed to facilitate. I'm not allowed to help the child do something wrong. But if the child on his or her own is doing something that an adult would not be allowed to do in the Jewish religion, we would say, leave the child. Don't get involved. Not your problem. However, says the Shach, even though that is true, if you see a child reaching for non-kosher food, even though you did not give it to the child, you did not facilitate, you did not encourage that behavior, you didn't tell them to eat it, says the Shach, you should stop the child from eating it, because that is not just violating one of the laws in the Torah, but that is something that can have a long lasting effect and consequence on that child, even when they become older. And therefore, as a result of that, the Shach says we should do whatever we can to allow the child to have great opportunities later on in life, which would include us making sure that that child is not going to eat what it is that they're about to eat, which seems to be something that is not permissible based on the halacha. Question. Now we go to the next step. Based on everything we said, we come to a tshuva in the Chelkas Yaakov. Who is the Chelkas Yaakov? And when did he live? If you had to guess, if he lived in the 1600s, 1700s, 1800s, what would your answer be? Or 1900s? Sometimes you can tell from the name of a sefer, like, you know, the style of the name. So what would you say the style of Racheli is?
Later.
Yes, correct. 1900s. Chelkas Yaakov is Reb Mordechai Yaakov Breisch, who was a survivor of the Holocaust and then moved to Switzerland and wrote a very important Shuva Sefer called the Chelkas Yaakov. So he has a discussion about a blood transfusion. The same way that the Rama says you're not allowed to have a child nursed from a non-Jewish woman because we're concerned maybe it's going to be metamtem es halev. Along comes the Chelkas Yaakov and he says, what happens when I'm in the hospital and God forbid I need a blood transfusion and we live in a blessed generation where the hospital is actually able to provide me with all the extra blood that I need. And the problem here is that I refuse to take blood from somebody who is not Jewish because that blood obviously came from a person who ate food that was not kosher. So would I be allowed to accept a blood transfusion when I know that that blood is coming from someone who did not keep kosher? You say yes, but isn't it the same? No, but the question is, if it's going to be what gives me life, that's now going to be inside of my body. So shouldn't that be the same thing? We have someone in our community who donated a kidney. Actually, a lot of people in our community who donated kidneys, which is so extremely inspiring. I was so depressed. I had swabbed a number of years ago, and then I got a call literally a week before my wife was due with our last child. And they were like, okay, you're a match. I'm like, great, I'm coming. And that was a crazy idea. And I remember I called Rabbi Leibowitz, who had just donated a kidney. Of course, he didn't tell anybody that he donated. Just 3 weeks before he gave it, every single shiur was about donating kidney. So it was about like, what happens to somebody on Shabbos if they're going to think of donating a kidney? And what happens if you have a wedding and you're in the middle of Shever Brachos and you donate? Like every single thing he spoke about, he threw in about the kidney, but he wouldn't say that it was him. And then he took off 2.5 weeks from his shul and nobody knew why. I was like, I think I might be able to tell all you guys why. Just look at YU Torah. Anyway, so he... So I remember I called Rabbi Leibowitz and I said, you know, I was called that I was a match for a kidney. And he's a big tzaddik, so he said to me, Shai, I love you, but at this stage of your life, it's a really bad idea. You have little children and you have to run around to take care of them. He's like, wait till your kids get a little older and that would be an appropriate time. And he said, it's not the same as donating something else. He said, donating a kidney, there are many people who are matches. It's not as if you don't give it, someone's going to die. If you don't give it, Baruch Hashem, in our community, we have a tremendous amount of altruistic kidney donors. And you're keeping yourself on the list that Amir Hashem, in the future, you'll have the opportunity to do it at a later point in time when it's more appropriate to do so for your family. So that is what he told me at the time, and that is what I did. But there is someone in our community who said he only has one regret about giving a kidney. His regret is that he can't do it again. But he did tell me that when he donated his kidney, I think there's an option if the recipient decides that he wants to meet the donor beforehand, he can, I think, I'm not sure. Or maybe this was before they had the protocols in place, I'm not sure exactly. But he met his recipient beforehand, and he said, I just have one request. His recipient was a non-religious Jew from Queens, and it was a Sephardi, and he said to him, my kidney has been keeping kosher for its entire life. I expect that my kidney will leave this world keeping kosher as well. That was his one request of the person, and the person started keeping kosher, from what I understand. So that is a very high expectation. But hey, I guess it's fair. I just saved your life, so I can dictate whatever I want. I don't know, but that was the deal. So here, Rabbi Yaakov Breisch in the Chelkas Yaakov discusses this. B'nidon, let's see what he says, a number dalet. B'nidon yare v'chared. You have somebody who's a real frum person. Ha'nitzrach ha'yideh ha'rofim iridah. And they need to have a blood transfusion. The doctors have said that that is the only way to survive. Im rashay ledaktek, am I able to insist, sheyia hadam, that the blood that I'm going to be given should only come me'anashim she'enam ochlim ma'achalos hasuras? Can I insist that the blood should only come from somebody who keeps kosher? I don't even know if that is possible. right? I don't think that's one of the databases that they have in the Mada Blood Bank in Israel. You know, like, do you keep kosher? And how strict, what kashrus agency do you follow? I don't know. But anyway, theoretically, that's his question. Benito didan, didam ha'acher nis'ari bedamo. Number one, he says, when you have a blood transfusion, that's not the only blood in your body. That becomes part of the whole system. So that becomes transfused into the person's body, which then joins up with the rest of the blood. He says, as far as I see it, I'm not sure why it should be any different. This is the person asking the question. Why should it be any different than somebody who drinks milk from a woman who doesn't keep kosher? Even though he says it would seem that there is a lot of room to say that these two cases are similar, the milk that a child is going to nurse from his mother and the blood transfusion that you're going to get from someone who's not keeping kosher, he said, when you come for a blood transfusion, the first thing you should ask is not, does the person keep kosher? That doesn't really make sense. If you have somebody who needs a blood transfusion, it's clear to me, he says, that if somebody requires a blood transfusion, it means their life is in danger. If that's the case, even though I can quickly make a phone call and tell one of my family members, come quickly to the hospital, I need blood to be donated, and I'm going to wait for you to come because I only want kosher blood. He said, don't take chances. Anyone who needs a blood transfusion obviously needs it because they have a major medical problem. And if we're going to start playing games of somebody waiting around until they get kosher blood from somebody who keeps kosher, that's a really bad idea, he says. And therefore, Rav Breish writes that it would be a very bad idea to wait around for that blood. The mitzvah shall v'chai b'hem yagein alav. Aye, what about the fact that I'm taking blood that's not kosher from somebody who kept non-kosher? Says the Chalkas Yaakov, the answer to that is, what's going to save you, the schus that you're going to have is the fact that you're being mekayim the mitzvah b'chai b'hem. That you're observing the mitzvah of, Hashem wants you to look after your own body. You're supposed to take care of yourself. U'legarish timtum halev u'midara. Anything bad that you would get from a non-kosher infusion into your body will be wiped out by the opportunity to do the mitzvah of v'chai b'hem. K'moshe shamati b'shem maran hagon ha-kodesh mi-belze. He quotes a very interesting insight from the Belzer Rebbe, the Yetzer HaRab, which is very unusual in the middle of a halachic tshuva that you quote like a line like this, but he says, the Yetzer HaRab shas chal yoshal adam. What Yetzer Hara is there when a person is sick? Usually when a person is sick, they don't feel good. They don't want to eat things that they shouldn't eat. They don't want to do things they shouldn't do. They don't want to talk about things that they're not usually supposed to talk about. So what Yetzer Hara is there? You think your Yetzer Hara is gone? The answer is no. What's the Yetzer Hara then? To try to be frum and not take care of yourself. Yetzer Hara shel adam b'shas chalyo she'ein lo kol taivos la'averes v'kasha lepatoso. The Yetzer Hara cannot find anything to get you to do wrong when you're sick because you have no appetite and you have no interest and you don't want to schmooze with people. You just want to lay in bed all day. Hu mifateo l'rov she'yaver ala mitzvah shel v'chai b'hem. The most powerful place where the Yetzer Hara gets involved when a person is sick is to convince them not to take care of themselves and not to do the mitzvah of v'chai b'hem. Bitzviuso. Bitzviuso means what? What? The Gemara says in Sota, Hizaru minat tzvuim. You know what that means? Be careful in life from people who are tzvuim, who are shady characters. What does it mean? People who flip-flop, people who don't stand for anything. I can deal with a tzaddik, I can deal with a rasha. I know what I'm dealing with, but when I'm dealing with a faker, it's very hard. That's what the Gemara says. So here he says, the Yetzer Hara tries to make you tzavua, tries to make you confused. Shadabar ze asur, v'dabar ze asur, he says, you're not allowed to do this, you can't do that, you can't take this treatment, you're not allowed to do that thing. Hakol v'chdei shelo yavo l'mitzvah shel v'chai b'hem. All he's trying to do is to convince you that you shouldn't do the one mitzvah that is the priority right now, which is the mitzvah of v'chai b'hem, the mitzvah of taking care of yourself. K'sheyesh l'fanav shnei minei damim, sheyachol l'rafosa l'fidas harofei. If I have two types of blood in front of me, v'yachol livcha v'hakasher, mamish beloshum dichoy v'ichor, he says, if I have two options, and the doctor walks in Shari Tzedek, and he says, listen, a frum person next door just gave blood for you, Would you like that or would you like this? So he says, if there's no delay, then maybe you can make that choice. However, even there, he says, I'm not so sure that you should make that choice deliberately, because maybe next time where you don't have a chance to wait and you're going to end off pushing it off when it's going to endanger your life because you're going to say, I need to wait around for kosher blood, you're going to remember what happened last time without remembering the detail of what happened last time, that both bloods were in front of you and you made a choice from what was in front of you at the time. Therefore, Abraish writes, he thinks this would not be a good application, which takes us a little bit further. Rav Avadya Yosef discusses the same thing in the Tshuva in the Abiya Omer. You look here in Chelek Ches, where Rav Avadya also comes to the same conclusion where he says it would make sense for a person to just accept a blood transfusion and not worry about whether the person who had given the blood is keeping kosher or not. However, Rav Avadya then says, what about accepting a kidney from somebody? Do I have to insist that when I'm waiting online for a kidney donation, I only want to accept one from somebody who is Shomer Torah Mitzvah, somebody who is going to be Shomer Kashrus? Do I have to have that insistence? You know Rabbi Dr. Aaron Glatt? He lives in our neighborhood. So he gave a shiur this Shabbos, which was very fascinating. It was all about whether or not AI is able to paskin a shayla. So he started off his shiur, which I thought was amazing. The answer, of course, is no. But he got to the point of explaining why no. So it was very interesting. So he started off the shiur by going through the discussion back and forth. And he said, he typed into AI, are we allowed to rely on a psak that AI gives us or not? So it gave him the argument yes, gave him the argument no. And then he said, when I have a machlokas between AI, says yes, AI says no. He put both of them into AI and asked, how do you come up with a conclusion? And they concluded that AI cannot pass in a shayla. Okay, very cute. Very sweet. So why am I saying that? Oh, so he said he decided he was going to put in a shayla into AI where there is absolutely no machlokas whatsoever to see how accurate is the answer going to be. Right? Let's see. Maybe on something that's just black and white, very simple, no machlokas, maybe we'll get it right. Even that I got wrong. So what was the shayla he put in? The shayla he put in, it's very hard to find the shayla where there is no machlokas. Right? You can always say there's a machlokas in the Rishonim, machlokas in the Tanaim, can always find something. How are you going to find something where there is absolutely no machlokas? You know what it is? I mean, there are many examples, but the example that he put in, because he's very up on medical issues, so he put in the example of, would a human being be able to accept a heart of a pig? So what do you think? What's it called? What? You know, this is research now that we can do this, right? You've seen this on the news? What? So you say no. Why do you say no?
I guess if it's that, but also you're not allowed to get hana from pigs.
Good question. Okay. The answer is unequivocally yes. You are allowed to accept the heart of a pig, which may totally change our entire world as we know it. If we can now start using animal limbs to save human lives, that could be an amazing breakthrough. But what he was saying was that there is absolutely no deliberation in halacha as to whether or not this is permissible. It is 100% allowed. What answer did they give it? What answer did AI give him? No. The answer that AI wrote was, Pikuach Nefesh is a very, it actually wrote it in like very yeshivish terms. So it said, I said, Rabbi Glatz, because you put it in yeshivish terms, so it's just talking your language. So it said, Pikuach Nefesh is a very important value, and therefore we would allow for a pig to be used because Pikuach Nefesh overrides any other consideration in halacha. That's not the answer. I mean, the conclusion is correct. It is mutter, but that's not the reason. It has nothing to do with Pikuach Nefesh. It's mutter because it's mutter. It's mutter because there's nothing wrong with it. Right? A pig is not Isurei Hana. A pig is an Isur Achila. Correct? Am I wrong? Yeah. Yes. So it's so ingrained in us that a pig is something that a Jew is not allowed to be a part of. What do you say?
You brought up you can't mix humans and pig.
Exactly. So it gives all kinds of convoluted answers. But his point was that this is something that is very much on the table today, very much in the discussion in the literature today. And Rabbi Avadya Yosef says, whoa, 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 before we get to a discussion about whether or not we can accept a heart from a pig, why don't we talk about whether or not you can accept a heart from somebody who doesn't keep kosher? Not that those are the same. Please don't make a mistake. Somebody who doesn't keep kosher is not at all like an animal. But the question is, if we say that we should try our best not to nurse a child because we're worried about timtum alev, we're worried about machalas asuras that's going to come inside of them from whatever it is that they're going to eat. Why don't we have a concern that maybe if I'm going to accept a limb or a body part from somebody who doesn't keep kosher, maybe that should be the same exact issue. And here Rav Avadya Yosef comes to the conclusion that he thinks this would not be a problem at all. Look at the last line, what I have here from the Abiya Omer. This is number Hey, which is on here. Look in the second page. Menira, Shehu Adin, Bechol Zeh Legabe Hashtalas Kloyos. This is the same when it comes to donating a kidney. Shem Ein Hadavar Dachuf, Ve'efshel Ahamtin. If it's not a rush, and it's not something that is so important to do immediately, then Tov Hadavar Lahamtin, Kedei Lahasig Kloyos Shel Yisrael Kasher, Kishehu Toreim Kloyos Shelo. If you have somebody who keeps kosher, then of course, that would be much better. But says Rav Avadya, you should not delay your opportunities to have a kidney because I'm going to wait around because maybe I'm going to get a kosher kidney that's going to come around later on. That's not something that would make sense because you are potentially jeopardizing or endangering your own life, and that is something that certainly the halacha would not encourage at all. Give me 1 second, you have a question. In fact, the Gemara says in Maseches Yuma, let's say you have a person who is not well on Shabbos. So we know the Gemara says in Maseches Yuma that you are allowed to be Mechala Shabbos in order to help them, in order to save their lives. You can drive them to the hospital. And then says the Gemara, you're even allowed to do other activities which they may need as well. So say, for example, the doctor comes in. Now, I don't know anything about the medical field, but it would seem very strange to me that a doctor would walk into the patient's room and say, you know, we have no medications to give you, but the only thing that's going to make you better is if you have freshly slaughtered meat. That would be something that would absolutely cure you. I don't think it connects to the reality that we have today, unless you have someone who is severely malnourished. I don't know, but I assume if somebody is severely malnourished, there are other ways to help rehabilitate them before we give them a fresh steak. But says the Gemara, theoretically, let's say they walk in on Shabbos and say, we need this individual who is sick to have fresh meat. So we have two options of what we can do. It's Shabbos. We don't have any meat available. So what do? We can either go to the next door neighbor who's a non-Jew who has non-kosher meat available, and we can cook that non-kosher meat, give it to the sick patient who needs it. Or we can take our kosher cow that is in the backyard and shech the cow on Shabbos, cook the meat, the kosher meat, and then give it to the patient on Shabbos. Which one should we do? Says the Gemara, in general, on Shabbos, whenever you have a conflict of something that needs to be done for a chola, says the Gemara, hakal hakal tchila. We try to do the least severe before we move on to something that is more serious of a prohibition. So which would be the more serious prohibition here? Should I eat non-kosher meat, which we already have readily available next door from the neighbor? Or should we actually go ahead and violate an additional prohibition by shechting, by slaughtering an animal on Shabbos, and then cooking it? Should I do that or should I do this? Which one would be better? What? You would say to eat the non-kosher meat would be better. Why? Because all I need to do is cook it. So you're only violating one thing wrong instead of doing two things wrong. Says the Gemara, it would seem from the way that the priorities are listed there, it would seem that it would be better to give the chola the kosher meat that we are going to have to slaughter on Shabbos and then cook instead of going to the next door neighbor and using the non-kosher meat. How can that be? How can that be? It's true. But says Rav Avadya, what do you see from there? What you see from there is how seriously we take this whole idea of machalas asuras. This is not a joke. And even when you have a chole who's allowed to eat it, but if we're going to give you the option of eating that or shechting something for you in order to eat it, we would rather violate those two prohibitions than to violate the isra of machalas asuras and give you something that is non-kosher from the next door neighbor. Yeah?
What if it was stealing?
Yes, stealing kosher meat versus...
Yeah.
So this is a big question. Would I be allowed to steal money in order to pay for my own treatments in the hospital? That's basically what you're asking. Forget Shabbos. I'm asking on Tuesday, right? Let's say I don't have money. I need a certain treatment. I need a medication. I can't afford it. So am I allowed to go and steal your car, sell it, and then I'll have money to pay for my treatments? You're saying no. Why not?
I mean, it doesn't sound rational.
Why not? Pikuach nefesh is docha kol haTorah kula. But it can't be, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense. So that's the answer to your question. We wouldn't even allow it on a Tuesday, so then we can't allow it on a Shabbos either. Right? That's not called, you know, that's not steal. I mean, it kind of is. The Gemara says that Gonev Amanas the Shalem, if I steal something from you and I say, okay, I'll pay you back later, that's also called stealing. Unless we are such close friends that we do this all the time. We have an arrangement. You take my things, I take your things. That's not called stealing. That's called borrowing back and forth. Yeah. So the Chasam Sofer has a very, very famous, well-known tshuva about a very upsetting case. He writes about a 7-year-old child who had he was a very healthy child, and all of a sudden he started hearing voices in his head, and that brought him from one place to another, and he continued to deteriorate, and he got so sick where the Chasam Sofer says, we had no choice but to deem him as a shote. We had no choice but to say, this child is no longer considered to be in his right state of mind. He's deranged. He's not able to communicate the way he used to. He's not able to understand anything the way he used to. And the family was very concerned. What do we do? The family didn't know how to take care of him. They were totally unequipped to deal with this problem. And the doctors came along and said, there was a new school that opened, a new program that opened somewhere, I think, in Vienna. And they said, why don't you send the child to this program? Maybe they can somehow rehabilitate the child and somehow give him some life skills that he'll be able to live a more comfortable life. And the only problem with the school was, it's not like today where we're so blessed to have opportunities for Jewish children to go to Jewish institutions. Back then, there was no Camp Hask, and there was no Camp Simcha, and there was no Yachad, and there was no Kesher, and none of these things that we have today. So the question then became, would I be allowed to send this child to an institution when I know that it's going to help the child have skills for life or make the child a little bit more comfortable, perhaps, but at the same time, they're not going to have a kosher option for this child. So I'm signing the kid up with the knowledge that by doing so, I'm going to have my child eat and digest non-kosher food for who knows how much time. That was the question that was sent to the Chasam Sofer. So he gets into a very detailed discussion in the Rishonim as to whether or not I would be allowed to do that as a responsibility of a parent. I have a responsibility to make sure that I do not facilitate my children to do something wrong. Is this called facilitating my child to do something wrong, or perhaps not? Facilitating my child to do something wrong means, Rahmana Litzlan, God forbid, I give my child a gun and I say, here, go into the street and do whatever you want. That's crazy. That's an irresponsible parent. You're basically giving your child a weapon and you're saying, you know, go do some terrible damage with this weapon. If I give my child the car keys and I say, you know, you're only 5 years old, but it's fine. You know, go take a little ride around the block. What do you think is going to happen? That's something that obviously any responsible parent would never do. Similarly, when it comes to prohibitions in the Torah, a parent is not allowed to facilitate their child doing something wrong. Now, is this called facilitating? All I'm doing is sending my child to an institution. The reason why I'm doing it is not because this institution is known for having the best food. The reason I'm doing it is because they have the best services that can be provided for this child. So is that called facilitating my child to do something wrong by sending them to the institution? Or do you say, no, I'm sending my child to the institution. It happens to be the institution then gives my child food. But that has nothing to do with me. That's as if I'm standing on the side and my child decides to walk over to a table somewhere and take some food. I don't have to stop the child. I'm not obligated to stop the child from eating whatever it is that they're eating. That's the big, very detailed discussion that he gets into. After all of that, the Chasam Sofer comes to the following conclusion where he says it would seem that it would be permissible based on the Rishonim. It's not called facilitating my child be adayim. It's not called giving the child something wrong actively. However, the Chasam Sofer then says the following very famous line, if you look here in the bold, where he says, although it probably would be permissible, however, he says, adayin ani omer, I still say, mutav sheyia shota kol yamav, says the Chasam Sofer, if I had to make this very painful and difficult choice for whether or not my child should have the facility that is going to help them become more of a functioning member of society that I as a parent cannot provide for them, but this facility can give it to them, says the Chasam Sofer, I would choose mutav sheyia shota kol yamav. I would prefer that he should remain in his incapacitated state for the rest of his life than to give him machalas asuras. That is the bottom line that the Chasam Sofer writes, which we do not accept. which we do not accept. And as you know, if you have opportunities for children or adults to go to institutions where they're going to be able to be helped, of course, the first thing we try to do is find an opportunity where there's a kosher option, but sometimes that's not a possibility. And the question is, would we be allowed to send someone there if it's going to give them a better quality of life that we cannot provide for them, or perhaps not? That is the major, major question that the Chasam Sofer raises. The reason why it's raised with him is because this was a new phenomenon. In the 1800s, this had just started, where they were providing services for children who had disabilities or who had major emotional or psychological, psychiatric issues. And that was something that was very new. And the Chasam Sofer was trying to grapple with the issue to figure out, what are we going to do when we don't have our own institutions that are considered to be kosher that are going to be a viable option for this child to go to? So that I always found to be a very fascinating tshuva. Again, this unfortunately comes up in our community all the time. We generally do not follow this Chasam Sofer as far as I understand. I don't think we do. But it's just important to know that he goes very much to the extreme because of his feelings about what machalas asuras does to a person. What does non-kosher food do not only to the act itself of eating it, of ingesting it, but to the rest of my life, that I'm going to have a impression of non-kosher food that went into my body? Yes, you have a question. Let's close with one final comment of the Divrei Yatziv, who is the Kloizenberger Rebbe. Kloizenberger Rebbe was a survivor of the Holocaust. He lost his wife and 11 children in the Shoah, and then he rebuilt the entire dynasty of Kloizenberg afterward, which is now a tremendously flourishing Hasidus in Eretz Yisrael and in America as well. So in the Tshuva's Divrei Yatziv, he writes the following. Ubi Yigeres HaRambam. He quotes the Rambam, where the Rambam says, Shekol ma shebo lidei hirhure kfira rachmana litzlan. All of those people who had hirhure kfira, which means people who had emuna issues, people who left the fold because they couldn't come to an understanding of, I don't know, what do you say, hirhure kfira? How do you describe that? Heretical feelings, heretical thoughts. Hakol mikoach she'achlu nevelus atrefus v'nitamtimu. Says the Rambam, all of that stemmed from the fact that they had an ingestion of non-kosher food. That's an amazing assumption of the Rambam. Uvedivrei Chaim, v'davar zeh yadua she'ein dvar avera kemachalas asura she'mitamtim alev Yisrael. And he says it is well known that there is no avera in the Torah that can be the same and as damaging as machalas asuris of avon osena harabim ayidezei yatsu kemat min hadas kama kihilos be'eretz loez ayidei hashov hakalim ve'achlu v'nispatim betreifos. He said, we live in communities where we rely on the shub. What is the shub? Shin vav beis. Anybody knows? Shochet or bodek. That means we rely on a shochet. A bodek means someone who's going to check afterward to assume that everything was done properly. That's the way all of us live our lives. We rely on people, and we trust them that there's a kashrus agency that's looking into something, that everything that's going on in the restaurant is kosher. I'm not going to be there. I don't really know what to look for. I don't know what's happening behind the counter in the kitchen. So he says, we rely on people, hakalim, who are not really serious, people who are not really understanding what their job is supposed to be. And as a result of that, there's non-kosher food that all of us are eating. Again, he says this back then, before we had a very serious kashrus apparatus as we have today. And he says, as a result of that, that is why we have so many people, in his opinion, who are unable to stay in the fold, who are unable to stay in the fray, because he says that they have, at some point in their lives, ingested machalas asuras, which has made such a negative impression on them. Again, a very extreme comment that he quotes from the Rambam, but something that gives us a little bit of an understanding of what Machalas Asuras actually is all about, and how seriously the Rishonim and the Gemara actually take it. You know, in our Parsha, we have so much discussion about the different animals. Let me just close with a Gemara Maseches Rosh Hashanah, where the Gemara Maseches Rosh Hashanah writes, "Bachamishi hayu omrim." What is the Shir Shal Yom of every single day? So we know, "Vayam Rishon hayu omrim LaShem Haaretz Emloam." "Vasheni hayu omrim Shir Mizmar LeLivnei Korach." Right, every day we have a different one. Says the Gemara, what do they say on the fifth day, on Thursday? What do we say? "Harninu LeLokim Uzenu." Hariu l'lokei Yaakov, right? We Harninu means we sing to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Says the Gemara, why do we say that on Thursday? Why should we sing extra special to HaKadosh Baruch Hu on Thursdays? What happened on Thursday? I know, Thursday is almost Shabbos, so it's a reason to sing, but why Thursday is so exciting? Says the Gemara, Al Shem Shebara Ofos V'dagim L'Shabeach Shemo. Because on Thursday, all of the birds and all of the fish were created. So therefore we should sing to him. Says Rashi, Kisha Adam Roe Ofus Mishunim Zemize. When I look around and I see all the different animals in the world, and I see how many different fish there are, and I see how many different birds there are, and I see what a beautiful world we have, no sein shevach lemisha baram. It brings a person to the conclusion that I have to thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for the beautiful world that we have. And that's why on Thursday, the Shir Shal Yom that we say is Harninu Lelukim Uzeinu. Because on the fifth day of creation is the day when all of these were created. And as a result of that, it gives all of us pause. It gives us the opportunity to think a little bit about how beautiful of a world we live in, how lucky we are to have all the different things that we engage with, that we encounter in our own lives, and how blessed we are that HaKadosh Baruch Hu put all of this here for us to enjoy and for us to take advantage of. So, as we read Parshas Shmini, and we have the opportunity to be reminded of the importance of Machalas Asuras, to be reminded of the importance of making sure that everything that we eat is kosher, and some things that you may not even think about are an issue, might be an issue. Some things that you think are an issue are probably not an issue as well in the other direction. But we all need to be aware. My father always says that, I remember he told us the story as children, that the OU was once asked to take over a plant of maple syrup. I think it was in Canada or something like that. So they sent the mashgiach out to the plant. There was a lot of discussion beforehand, like, what could possibly be wrong with maple syrup? There's nothing in there. It's maple syrup. So they were discussing, what are the ingredients of this, everything. Okay, it sounded easy. They sent a, like, junior mashgiach. What's the big deal? Like, what could possibly go wrong? To go check out the plant. Like, what are you going to see there already? So they send him out there, and he gets there, and much to his surprise, he's looking through the whole production line, and he sees everything is exactly the way they described it without any difference. And then, after they finish the entire production, before they put all of the maple syrup into the bottles that they're going to be sold in. So everything goes into a big vat. And he said they have a huge open vat in the room and a pole sticking out from the ceiling that every 5 or 10 seconds goes down for a dip into the maple syrup. And what is hanging on that pole? An entire pole full of pigs. Entire pole full of pigs. They dip it into the maple syrup right before they put it into the bottles. What it gives, I don't know, must give some kind of texture or something that goes into it right before they bottle it. But he said, who would have thought? Who would have imagined? It's maple syrup. What can possibly be wrong? But you never know. You have to look into things. You have to be aware of what it is that you're eating. And as you see from the Rishonim and from all the discussion in the Achronim as well, this is something that it seems is taken very, very seriously. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Ani Hashem Hamala Eschem Me'eretz Mitzrayim. Why is Kashrus connected at all to Yetzias Mitzrayim? The answer is because HaKadosh Baruch Hu is watching. And just like the Ribono Shel Olam is the one who is able to tell the difference and make the distinction between the Bechor Mitzrayim and the one who is not a Bechor, so too HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows those people who are careful about Kashrus and those people who are not. So you may say to yourself, well, there is a Kashrus symbol and really it's not so bad and really it doesn't matter and what's the big deal? I'm going to this hotel for Pesach and I'm going there and I'm doing this and I'm doing that and it seems many other people are doing it. The answer is, Ani Hashem Hamala Eschem Me'eretz Mitzrayim. Ani Hashem Hamala Eschem Me'eretz Mitzrayim. Yes, it's true. Many people may not be as careful as you are, but it's not a bad idea to be careful about Machalos Asuras. It's something that the Torah certainly puts a big priority on, and it's something that certainly during the Yom Tov of Pesach, where the whole discussion about Machalos Asuras is contingent on Hamotzi Eschem Hamala Eschem Me'eretz Mitzrayim, certainly on Pesach, it's something that we all need to be aware of, we all have to be thinking about. We all have to make sure that whatever arrangements we have for the upcoming Yom Tov are ones that are going to be kedas ukedin, that are going to be up to the standard that we should hold ourselves to, not only on Pesach, but throughout the duration of the rest of the year as well. Okay.